So I ended up being a nomad, going to different fab labs across the globe for 2 years. I formulated how I could. I realized that the fab lab network is a really interesting place for distributing these digitally shared designs that we discussed with local manufacturing capability. So I went across the globe for 2 years, from fab lab to fab lab, trying to figure out how to make this happen. And I ended up falling in love with the local community impact of this lab so much that I realized I want to start one in my hometown.
Welcome back to the SOLIDWORKS Born to Design podcast, a collection of inspiring stories about those who create, build, invent, and engineer new ideas into actual new products. And by the way, they all use SOLIDWORKS. I'm your host, Cliff Melling, and I want to thank you for joining us for this episode of the Born to Design podcast, Machines Building Machines. Today, I'm talking with Jens Dybig, who is an industrial designer and Fab Lab founder who has traveled the world for 2 years, visiting Fab Labs all over the globe. He has also designed a CNC machine that can build another CNC machine, which allows Fab Labs to start up quicker. Jens shares his adventures and many stories of inventors and makers around the world. So let's jump right into that interview.
Yeah, so I'm an independent researcher and industrial designer based in Norway. And what I'm here in Waltham, I'm working on the behalf of the Center for Bits and Atoms at the MIT to install a machine that is part of the FabLab 2.0 development, which means that these are digital fabrication machines that you can make in a digital fabrication facility like a FabLab. So open hardware usually. That means you can download actually and study the recipe of the machine, and that without too much experience you don't need to be a trained factory worker or a professional craftsman. You can actually load these files into a machine in your local fab lab and make the parts for your own machine. And this particular machine that I'm installing here, it's a CNC router with a 4-foot by 8-foot work area, so quite a massive machine. And you can load in a 4-foot by 8-foot sheet into the machine and cut out about 85% of the parts for a new machine. So you store by about 15%, so which is quite a high degree of DIY. There are so many motivations behind this, but we've been joking a little bit about it hopefully being a gateway drug to machine building, that once you can download and make this machine yourself, and that will be a way to get familiar with basic machine design and structures and control systems that allows you to make new kinds of machines that don't exist yet. And that's when it gets also really exciting, right? So replicating the classics, or making an open recipe for a classic type of machine that makes it possible to study and understand, and then easier also in the future make new machines that don't even exist yet.
Exactly. And so if a new fab lab was starting off, this is a great opportunity for them to build a very important CNC machine that would cost them how much if they wanted to buy one new?
Yeah, so it's a classic challenge of like, what good of a machine do you want to buy? But typically in fab labs, they source the CNC machine from around $25,000 to $30,000. And
your machine is basically the materials and those 15% of parts, right? Which would be roughly how much?
Roughly about $5,000 if you source that as an individual using US web shops. But then, of course, if you would create such a machine in the commercial settings, you have to remember your labor hours, right? Which makes the machine considerably more expensive. But that's also the exciting part of like, say you don't make this on the behalf of somebody else, you just want to bootstrap your own fab lab or your own fabrication business, or just have this as a rewarding hobby. You can invest man hours instead of money, right? Which makes this more accessible. So if you can make that initial investment of $5,000 for the bill of materials, then you can put your own hours into creating the rest of the machine, and you will know how to how to service it, how to repair it, right? How to improve it.
Exactly. And it fits right into the purpose of the Fab Lab, right?
Yes, yeah. Exactly. It fits with the Fab spirit. So there's already a really nice sort of global community of people building their own machines, and it is becoming more accessible thanks to the digital fabrication machines becoming better. We have better software for CNC routers and milling machines. We have better 3D printers, and that makes more people come on board, which is exciting.
Absolutely. I was just looking at the small router that you were using, and it. My router at home is like 15 years old, and it's a big clunky thing. But hey, it still works. But this is great. And so is that the goal of building this, is to help other Fab Labs be able to start up quicker?
That's one of them. Yes, but we built the prototype of this machine in our Fab Lab in Oslo in Norway, and people got so excited about this machine. When I put it together in the open space, when they heard about the story behind it, it's like, wow, you actually designed it, and you can actually like fabricate on this part. And like, what are you doing now? Yeah, I'm actually copying the machine. I'm making new parts that's going to Dassault in Waltham. So that sort of inspirational side, the sort of little bit sort of feeling of magic side is triggering like an eagerness to learn more about machine design. Maybe that's the stronger motivation for me.
No, I agree. You mentioned the Fab Lab spirit. I think that's great. And as I've talked on this podcast many times before, there's a lot of young designers who are great at design, but they also need to understand how things are manufactured. So this gives them that value as well.
Yeah, right? Because three-axis CNC milling has a lot of geometric limitations, right? Like sharp internal corners, undercuts, and so on. But the whole machine is almost like a textbook in designing for CNC machining and working with joinery and fasteners with CNC machining. So you can it's like a little lookup textbook for design techniques for CNC machining, which fits for a CNC machine, right?
Right, exactly. So what's the ultimate goal? Where is this going?
Yeah, so the reason I'm here at Dassault actually is because we're setting up a mirror lab of a Fab Lab that Dassault is supporting to get started in Haiti next year. And they're collaborating with the Center for Bits and Atoms at MIT to make this happen. And it has been decided to take this leap of like, let's create a new Fab Lab with machines made in a Fab Lab instead of the traditionally mass manufactured factory made machines, which is super exciting, but also comes with challenges. And then it makes extra sense to have a copy here in the United States of the machines that get sent, so that local technicians here can help with troubleshooting because there's a reference, right? So that's why there's actually two machines that I'm delivering now. One is getting installed here in Waltham, and the other one will be shipped to Haiti to be part of the Fab Lab that's getting started in Haiti next year.
That's outstanding. That's outstanding. And I love the fact that you're building one here to help them out. So why Haiti? Is there a new opportunity for young minds that are very interested in next steps? So why did you pick Haiti? Just curious.
Yeah, so I personally did not pick Haiti, so I cannot answer that directly. But to my understanding, the potential for a positive impact is really big there, like bigger than most places. But it's equally much more challenging to create a successful Fab Lab as well, because of logistics and infrastructure on the ground, political climate and so right. on. So it's you could say it's a high stakes project. It seems like that to me, but it's also a very exciting project. And the fact that, for instance, spare parts for this machine that we're delivering can be sourced easily by an individual without, you don't need to have like a special business relationship, set up an account with an established industrial supplier. You can, as an individual, source the components if they break down, or have them fabricated for you. Hopefully will help keeping the machine running for a lower cost.
That's great. That's excellent. Yeah.
Because this is luckily also the second generation of these machines that we're doing. So in Norway, there's actually been made 11 machines of the first generation of, like, so we had the makerspaces, private individuals, schools who made the versions of our first design. And from everything we learned there, challenging with longevity of components, maintenance frequency, and so on, all that's been taken into account now, which hopefully will make this a suitable machine for a fab lab. And it's been tested as good as we can, but we're going to keep testing the machine here at Voltan before we ship to IET, because it is a big responsibility that, you know, we certainly cannot send a machine, or should not send a machine, that will break down within a few weeks, right, or months. We need to deliver.
Right, right. And the whole idea is, once it's there, they could build a second machine, right? And then they have a backup that could put any parts together.
Exactly. Yeah. So that's one of the potentials, right? Is that the fab lab there can clone itself and potentially in the future become a hub and a source of knowledge for automation and production of electromechanical systems and so on. So.
That's excellent. That's excellent. And we should mention you have some experience with fab labs. You started the one in Oslo, right?
Yeah, together with great peers, I started a fab lab in Oslo, in Norway. So we started that initiative in 2011, and we recently had a 10-year anniversary, and we started our own organization from scratch. So it's as a non-profit, we organized the Fab Lab and step by step built up maybe one of the most comprehensive Fab Labs in Europe.
That's great. And why did you decide you were instrumental in starting up that one in Oslo, but you took a step away from that to do what you're doing now? What inspired that?
Yeah, so that was actually the plan all along.
And
I remember I was having a conversation with my peers back in 2015. I went from working, you know, part-time with a nonprofit to full-time. And I said, I'm going to do this full-time for 5 years. But after that, I'm going to have the need to make stuff myself is going to be so strong that then I'm going to go and work as industrial designer again. So that worked out. So for a long time, it was, I call it sort of meta creativity or design by proxy, that I created a fab lab and taught people how, mentored people and using the machines and choosing materials and design techniques for a long time, and sort of got to fulfill my creative needs to a certain degree by watching their enthusiasm and joy, like learning new techniques and realizing their projects. But then I do have a strong need to create things and use my hands.
Absolutely.
So that's why I made the shift, stepped out of running the Fab Lab together with my peers and working independent now.
Okay. But part of that working independent is refining this CNC design that was built for, to be able to ship pieces and be almost completely created off of one 4x8 sheet of material and everything, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's great. And all this is Jens mentioned is open source, and you can download his model and build your own, and that's fascinating. Yeah,
yeah,
that's great.
Yeah, and by sharing not just exported files but actual source files from FreeCAD, you can actually modify the design too. So you can make it longer, wider, adjust the material thickness, and so on.
That's great. That's great. So where did this all start? Where did your interest in design come from? Obviously, you wanted to build things when you were younger, but where did that all begin?
Yeah, so I was a very creative kid, I believe. Like, I made a lot of stuff, at least, and definitely, you know, played with Legos and built soapbox racers and so on. But I have a very clear memory of being like a very young teenager telling my mother that I want to design cars when I grow up.
Right.
And then she said, I think you need to become an industrial designer to do that, Jens. And then I remember I looked up industrial design and thought, like, hey, this is great. And over time, the interest in designing cars faded. But I realized that industrial design would give me the freedom to create such a good diversity of physical objects that would be the study for me.
That's great. It's always Legos. Every designer I've talked to, they all had Legos, right?
Yeah.
After you had that interest in design, tell us more about where you went to school and how that happened. So.
Yeah. So I went to some foundation courses in Norway and Denmark, and then I did my main studies undergrads at the Design Academy Eindhoven in the Netherlands, which was a fantastic school to go to, where what I really liked about that school was like you didn't just learn how to design something good like from a rational perspective, but you also were really much trained to think about why are you doing this and what you're trying to use your creativity to put out in the world, how does that relate to the society you see around you. So lots of critical thinking in that education, which was good. But that school did not have any digital fabrication machines. So I discovered a fab lab in Amsterdam that was started by the Wach Society. And I ended up doing my internship in that fab lab with the Wach Society in 2008. And that was just such a good experience for me. I started drawing in the computer when I was 6 years old, and I've been making things all my life. But then around the age of 26, roughly, these two worlds came together, like CAD design and digital fabrication, and that just clicked for me. And then the Wach Society they were quite eager on open design and the potential of a shared design. And you know, Professor Neil Gershenfeld at the Center for Bits and Atoms, he formulates quite nicely this you know, that bits and bytes can fly around the world, but you can produce things locally with these locally distributed digital fabrication tools. And that really resonated with me, because I saw in design school, like, the best ideas never happen. That if you, the further a design at the degree show was from an established design, or the more like either provocative or cutting edge or different, then the more difficult it would be find somebody to make the massive investment in tooling to mass manufacture this at an affordable cost, and then again finding a retailer or distributor. So I got super curious to this sort of, can we use this peer-to-peer manufacturing system that is developing to get our ideas out in the world in a different way? And would that potentially then lead to more exciting objects being part of everybody and products being part of people's lives?
That's great. That's great. Yeah, and I totally agree.
It did turn out to be a bit more difficult than I imagined. Like,
yeah.
Hardware is hard, like they say about startups, but it's also, I come to, for instance, grown fond of the charm of sort of a little bit more crudely designed objects. So if you look at like how you have the expression of something, the visual expression of an injection molded object, which is so refined often. Sometimes more two-dimensional structures that's been CNC milled or laser cut and then assembled together, they have their own visual identity that can actually be appealing as well. So you don't necessarily need to replicate the same standard either in order for an object to have a value. You know, it's nice that it can have its own identity also.
That's a great point. That's a great point, because you want to see it built as well. Because it's always great when you have an idea and you can design it in SOLIDWORKS, right? And you see it come to life on screen. But if you're actually, again, I mean, yes, you can 3D print it, but if you actually have to build it, put it together, there's got to be another level of excitement putting that piece together.
Absolutely.
Than just seeing it on screen, right? That's good, yeah. Great point.
I wanted to follow up on, I ended up doing a research project on this distributed open design that really brought me into the Fab Lab world.
Okay.
So I ended up being a nomad, going to different fab labs across the globe for 2 years. So I sort of, yeah, formulated how I could, I realized that the fab lab network is a really interesting place for distributing these digitally shared designs that we discussed with local manufacturing capability. So I went across the globe for 2 years from fab lab to fab lab, trying to figure out how to make this happen. And I ended up falling in love with the local community impact of this lab so much that I realized I want to start one in my hometown.
That's great.
And that really got me into the network, you could say.
So after the 2 years of going all over the world, how did that get started? Did you talk to Dr. Gershenfeld and tell him you wanted to do this, or how did that work?
Yeah, but that's the nice thing about the Fab Lab network is like you don't need approval, right?
Yeah.
So there's actually a super nice Fab Lab way up north in above the Arctic Circle, like 20 in Norway, like 24
really?
Hours by car from where I grew up. If you go north.
Oh wow.
And they were working closely with. It's called FabLab Lingen, and they were working closely with the CBA to get started. And they just had in October, their 20th year anniversary. So So they were one of the very first labs. And I thought, like, that would be a symbolic first place to start, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So I just called up the manager there, and he said, you're welcome anytime. And that's basically how it went from there on. And then Neil Gershenfeld and his team were very supportive of me joining the Fab conference that was in Peru that first year of my travel. So I went there. And at the Fab conferences, I got to know a lot of people in person. So then it became even easier to go to the next destination.
Oh,
so
interesting.
I worked my way through Europe and then Oceania, Asia, North, South America, and then ending in Africa.
That's excellent. So you got to see the whole world and inspire others with the Fab Lab. That's great. That's excellent.
It was a really special 2 years of my life.
Oh, absolutely! I can imagine.
Probably the wisest decision I made was to do that. And I was supposed to go back to grad school, but that didn't happen because in those 2 years, sort of symbolically became like a graduate degree.
I was about to say, I'm sure you learned more in 2 years of traveling the world, going to Fab Labs, than you would have at a grad school.
And then all of a sudden I found myself occasionally teaching classes for both undergrads and grad students, and I realized, like, I don't think I need a degree to continue doing what I want to do in life.
I don't think so. So a couple more questions that I have, and then we can all, if you have other things you want me to cover, we can definitely do that. So you've been around the world, you've seen a lot of these Fab Labs. What do you think are the biggest technical, logical advancements, or what is the one, even not technical, I shouldn't even say technical, but what are the biggest advancements in design that you've seen in your time going around? What has helped with design and collaboration around the world, or maybe collaboration is the answer. So
I think you have the answer right there. The shift in attitude. Right, that from this silo thinking, or everybody being on their island, to like more and more people realizing, like, you can stand on the shoulder of giants, and you can both, you know, benefit and give into this knowledge sharing, and you can do that also without being, you know, you don't necessarily need to be so hardcore that you share your designs fully openly in a public repository like I do. You know, it can also just be simple conversations you have in the Fab Lab meeting, you know, fellow users of the Fab Lab, but that sort of general attitude of like, if I share know-how I have with you and you do that back with me, and I can find relevant documentation on the internet, and I will give back by also putting back documentation on the internet, then that's probably the biggest change. And that meshes so well with this network of digital fabrication labs. That reminds me of, I once expressed like this really interesting feeling I had when I visited the Fab Lab in Kamakura in Japan for the first time. It was my first time in Japan. I was touring around the world, and I get there by plane, by train, by bus, and then by walking. And then I walk into this building that I, in a country I've never been before, and it feels like I'm walking into my living room. Like this super interesting like mix of like, one, because the Fab Lab machines, the laser cutters, milling machines, 3D prints kind of standardized. So I knew already how to use all the equipment, but also the attitude of the people there and the willingness to support each other and do that knowledge exchange made it really feel like coming home, even though I was in a foreign country for the first time.
That's great. That's interesting. So home for you has to have a CNC machine in it, right?
Yeah, and the right attitude.
Yeah, the right attitude. Yeah, yeah. No, that's great. That's excellent. I actually wrote down attitude. That's awesome. That's awesome. This is great stuff. This is excellent. So in your mind, where are we going? What's the future of design, or where would you like it to be, or what do you think's going to change, or is it just going to be more collaboration and more changing attitude?
When I got super interested in sort of digitally distributed designs and local manufacturing, then that interest really kicked off for me a bit more than 10 years ago. I must admit, I thought the development would be going faster. We have machines have gotten more refined, software has gotten more refined, it's easier to work with, but it's not like dramatically different than it was 10 years ago.
Right.
So if you follow that arc 10 years into the future, we're not on the brink of some revolution like a lot of people talked about, like especially amid the very top of the hype curve of the 3D printers, the word revolution was thrown around a whole lot. And I remember like disagreeing with that, like we're in the middle of a nice evolution here, not like a revolution.
Right.
But then maybe, maybe a revolution of mindsets could be correct to say, yes.
Right.
But I've been also like a little taken aback by how difficult it is actually to do professional local manufacturing. So one thing is that you can load files into a machine, but you know, maybe you need to do some finishing, like either in woodworking, you might talk about, you know, sanding and oiling or gluing and assembling or edge breaking or maybe if it's going to be a commercial project, you need to do some good packaging and so on. And there's no like technological fix for that, you could say, in a way, right?
I agree. I feel like we're losing some skills. You know, America was built on assembly and manufacturing, and nobody's, everything's automatic, right? We're losing the skills of refining those. So
both to document and share those sort of manual finishing skills is important. But actually, that makes me realize that, like, you know, tool changing is trickling down, like that, you know, that it's been used in automation for a very long time, that six-axis robots, industrial robots, they change their end effectors automatically so they can do multiple tasks. And then, you have machining centers in CNC milling machines that can automatically change between all kinds of cutting tools to automate production and also help have more finished, have objects come out of the machines to a much more finished degree. And that is becoming... it's becoming much more accessible. So, for instance, Jake Reed over at the CBA at MIT is doing super good research on very simple to fabricate tool changers that you can put on your own machine. And then all of a sudden you can swap actually from a cutting tool for milling to a sanding tool, for instance. Wow. Or you can put in a marker to work or a printhead to do graphics. Or something that I'm personally working on is combining rough large-scale additive manufacturing with subtracting manufacturing, so that you can print rough and fast, and then use machining for finishing. And that's also something that's been done industrially, especially with metal, but that's becoming much more accessible now, and that's something that I'm excited to be part of. So you could say multi-process in one machine is coming, but again, also much more difficult than you would think. But the sort of the good news and the bad news is that it's largely a software problem. So if you find a solution, you make good software, it's easy to share and distribute around the world, but it's also not that easy to make good software for multiple end effectors and processes.
Right. Yeah, that's right. That's something you discussed yesterday. So yeah, using, so you could build like a, as you mentioned, I think a blob and with a 3D printer, but then use subtractive manufacturing, milling it to refine the tool.
And making that more accessible, I think is really exciting. And also from a sustainability point of view, that's a big part of my motivation to work on this, because there's been quite a lot of nice efforts to make small machines for recycling 3D printed objects into new filament again.
Right.
But it turns out that that's really difficult to do to the standard that you need. Like, you want a really consistent diameter on filaments for 3D printers. And that's typically closed loop monitored in a factory and controlled, and it's difficult to do on your own. So I believe quite strongly in that you can just shred the plastics, and instead of extruding it into filament that you spool up, you just extrude it straight into the objects that you're making. Like, so you have these really rough beads that you lay down, and then you can, with the CNC cutting tool, go and machine it for precision.
Oh, interesting. And yeah, I've seen that. I've seen how them take plastic bottles and use them for filament. So yeah. You're saying, just
directly,
cut them up and,
directly. Okay. Because then you don't have such high demand for tolerances, because you want to over-extrude a bit anyway, so that you can then cut off to final dimensions with the cutting tool. And that opens up also interesting aesthetics, because you can, again, with smart CAM software, you can then selectively, like locally, mill for precision where it's needed. And then you can work with aesthetics of the rough beads of plastics and the layers where it's not needed. Maybe even like go in and oscillate the tool paths, so that you have a really interesting visual texture in the non-critical surfaces. And then where you have mating surfaces and so on, then you go in and machine for precision that. I think that's really exciting.
That is. Yeah.
Embrace the aesthetics of the manufacturing technology while you still also keep good tolerances for mating objects. One remark that I had here in the conversation here the other day about machine building is a little anecdote about my own personal experience building my first milling machine like 6 years ago. And when I was in, you know, it's actually like 11 years ago since I first got introduced to using a CNC machine myself, which really changed things for me, like not giving somebody a file, but I could operate that machine myself, which was great for like learning and creativity and exploring. But I was always a bit cautious, because I knew that if I crashed this machine too hard, then it would have significant consequences, both for economically and downtime for this fab lab where I'm getting to use this machine. But once I put together my own small milling machine for the first time and I was starting to play with it, I noticed that my behavior and attitude was so different. I was completely fearless to do any kind of silly experiments, try out, like I made my own CAM software to make toolpaths in a freer way, and running that and experimenting with that just felt so nice. And I do think that can accelerate the learning curve a lot if you have that sort of fearless attitude on equipment that you know how to maintain and that you built yourself. And who knows, maybe that also accelerates the development of finding golden nuggets, the discovery, right, of new shapes, techniques, objects.
Right. Well, that's an interesting point. Great point. That's why all these fab labs need two of your machines, right? Just in case they break one.
Yeah. And they,
if
and
they're
the big,
fearless. Yeah.
The big challenge will be like, how do we get them to make them themselves, right?
Right, exactly.
And then, you know, that's why we need good documentation as well.
Right. Well, it'd be great to connect with you in like 4 years and see how well it's done, and see how many of your CNC machines are in fab labs all over the world. How many total are there? Just curious. Fab labs, you know?
Oh, way more than 1,000.
1,000, right?
Yeah,
okay,
yeah.
I was going to say probably half that. Okay, wow, 1,000. That's excellent. That's excellent. Well, Jens, this is a great conversation. A lot of great stuff here. I really enjoyed this. Your experience is, and what you're doing is great. You know, supporting these fab labs, and I look forward to hearing how things go in Haiti as well. So this is good.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
And for those listening, if you're not involved in a fab lab, I don't know why you wouldn't after listening to this presentation. So so hopefully you can get involved in your local fab lab or start one, and with Jens' new milling machine here. So excellent. Thank you for listening today. I hope you enjoyed hearing from Jens. If you are a maker or inventor looking for a community in which to share and collaborate and learn more about the many tools SOLIDWORKS offers for makers, go to solidworks.com/maker and join the Makers Made in 3D community, a space where all are welcome to learn, engage, discover, share knowledge, and network with other makers. Again, learn more at solidworks.com/maker. We'll be back again soon with more great Born to Design podcast stories at solidworks.com/podcast or wherever podcasts are readily available. Until then, keep innovating. I really hope that what you heard today has inspired you. If you enjoyed it, head on over to iTunes, search for the Born to Design podcast, and please leave us a 5-star review so that this podcast will be recommended to more people, helping us expand the Born to Design community. Thank you.